Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. It's very, very exciting. So my presentation centers around American Indians with respect to health as a human right, because interestingly, American Indians and Alaska Natives are one of the only populations in the United States that are actually legally entitled to health care. But what's interesting is how the federal government has interpreted that legal obligation and how they've been very creative and very innovative in failing to uphold that obligation. So I'll go through some of those strategies with you today. So in order to create some context for my discussion, it's really important to understand the fundamental obligation that the federal government has to American Indians, and we call that the federal trust obligation. So American Indians and American Indian tribes have a unique relationship with the federal government. It's a government-to-government relationship. Each tribe is a sovereign nation. They establish their own citizenship. Many have their own laws and their own agencies. So in essence, they're like little governments. Tribal members, in essence, have dual citizenship. We're members of our tribe. I'm a member of the Pueblo of Laguna, but I'm also a U.S. citizen. And that relationship that we have with the federal government is not based on race. Very often I hear non-Indians, there's some confusion. Well, you're just another racial or ethnic group. But we actually have a unique political status as tribal members in a relationship with the federal government. I also hear people say that this is one treaty. It's based on a certain treaty with the federal government. It's actually a complex series of different treaties, executive orders, and laws. But ultimately, the federal government is legally obligated to provide economic and social programs necessary to raise our standard of living and social well-being comparable to non-Indian society. So as Charlie said earlier, that the right to health care, the right to live a healthy life and have access to health care is a core fundamental right. The federal government recognizes that they have a legal obligation to do the same for American Indians. So I want to make sure that everyone leaves today. This is a learning objective. American Indians do not get free health care. I hear that a lot. Well, don't you get free health care? You all have casinos and you're making tons of money. No, in essence, we have prepaid health care. So you can see from this map in 1492, prior to Columbus, the United States was Indian land, and Native people have a very different concept about land. We don't really consider land ownership. The earth is our mother, and land can't really, at that time especially, couldn't be owned by people. But 400 years later, by 1890, I don't know if you can see this map, there's just tiny areas around the United States that are actually Indian lands and reservations. So I really like the takeaway here. We did pay for health care because we ceded millions of acres to the federal government. And we'll actually run through an example of what that looks like in Albuquerque. So Indian health care is included in this legal obligation that the federal government has to American Indians. We did pay for it by relinquishing and ceding these millions of acres of land. And the Indian Health Service is the primary provider of health care services to Indian people. But the problem with the Indian Health Service is it's a discretionary program. It's not like Medicaid or the VA. So funding is appropriated by Congress each year, and it's really based on the political will that exists. So for decades, it's been chronically underfunded, and currently funded at about 54% of the actual need. The system is very fragmented and unstable, and I'll show you an example of that. So just to see how this plays out in terms of dollars, last year in 2012, the average that an individual in the United States spent on personal health care was about $7,600, and the Indian Health Service spent about $2,700. It's very minimal services, minimal funding. And Charlie mentioned earlier about prisoners' rights in Alcatraz. One of their rights was health care. Interestingly, I usually have another graph to share with you, but the federal prison system spends almost twice as much for health care than the Indian Health Service. So sadly, Indian people have a saying, if you want really good health care, you might want to look at the correctional system to access. Not actually funny, but. So in 2010, it's interesting, our population, Indian people make up, American Indians and Alaska Natives, we make up about 1.7% of the U.S. population. And interestingly, 78% of us live away from the reservation and tribal lands. So my family has lived off the reservation for three generations now. And federal policy encouraged this migration, but today many people leave the reservation to pursue educational opportunities or employment opportunities. But when you leave the reservation, it has significant impacts on your access to care and the obligation the federal government has to providing that care. So this slide is designed just to share with you the complexity of the Indian health system. And let's see if I can walk over here. So you can see the federal government is responsible for funding the Indian health care system, but it's funded, the IHS has funded about 54% of the actual need, so that's the primary recipient. I think their budget last year was a little over $4 billion. And then a significant amount of money is provided to states for their Medicaid programs. So the Indian health system and then the state Medicaid program really bear much of the responsibility for providing health care to Indian people. So the challenge with that is the way Medicaid is structured, and I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with how it's financed. It's a joint program between the federal government and states. So in New Mexico, for every $3 that New Mexico contributes to Medicaid, the federal government pays $7. So it's about 30-70 match. Interestingly, recognizing the federal government recognized that they had an obligation to provide health care and they wanted to be cautious about shifting that obligation to states. So if American Indians receive health care services in an IHS setting or in a tribal clinic or tribal facility, the federal government matches those Medicaid dollars 100%. So it's basically a pass-through. So no 30% match from the state, it all comes from the feds. But that same match rate does not apply to urban Indian health programs. And we'll talk about that. Because as Indian people move away from the reservation, it's far less likely that they would receive services in an IHS or a tribal setting. So by failing to provide that 100% match rate, in some ways, that is diluting that responsibility that the federal government has. So there's another program in the Indian health system, we'll go through it in a little bit more detail, but it's called the Contract Health Services Program. So if services are not available in the IHS, you can make a request to receive those services through another program. But eligibility for that program is extremely complex and typically based on residency. We'll talk about that. I just want you to see it's complicated and very fragmented. It's based on congressional appropriations, so it's unstable. So the Contract Health Service Program, I'll just give you an example from Albuquerque. I do a lot of advocacy and actually work directly with consumers. So last year, I had a young woman, she was 19, 20 years old. She wasn't eligible for Medicaid. Because she wasn't pregnant and, you know, not under 19. And she was in a car accident. She was taken by ambulance to a local hospital. So obviously that wasn't a service that our local IHS facility could provide. So she had to go through the Contract Health Service Program. And there's four basic requirements for that program. So the first one is you have to notify IHS within 72 hours that you need that service. And because she was taken by ambulance and her parents were really distraught, they didn't notify IHS. So they actually denied the claim simply because she hadn't notified them within 72 hours. The second requirement is residency. So you typically have to live on the reservation to be eligible for this program. In this instance, this young woman did not live on the reservation. the program is extremely complicated. So if your reservation is within this contract health service delivery area, you may be eligible for care. So in this case, she didn't meet the notification requirement, but she did meet the residency requirement because her tribe was actually, her tribe was located in this county. But then the third requirement is medical priority. So typically, the Indian Health Service is on what they call level one priority. So they're really only going to cover services that are sort of life or limb, emergency in nature. So for example, you might not be able to get a mammogram, but you might be able to get services when you're actually dying from cancer. So it's extremely unjust system. And then the last requirement is the IHS is the payer of last resort. So individuals who make requests under this program have to utilize other funding before they go through this. So financial assistance from a local hospital, charity care programs, apply for Medicaid, and so forth. So bottom line, with this program, two-thirds of the claims are denied. And in this case, this girl, her claim was denied, and she had to get financial assistance from the local hospital. And believe me when I tell you that this results in late and delayed care. People end up with significant health problems because they haven't gotten the care in a timely manner, and even death. Another facet of the Indian health system is the ability for tribes to actually assume management of their own health programs. So many tribes around the country have become somewhat frustrated with the Indian health system, and they become far more sophisticated and more innovative in developing their own healthcare programs. So many of them are taking that money from the federal government, building their own clinics, developing their own programs, and so forth, which has had very positive results in many tribal communities, especially Alaska is really sort of a benchmark for some amazing things that they've been able to do. But what you have to be mindful of is the tribe, again, a sovereign nation, can determine who accesses their programs. And so locally in New Mexico, I'm speaking for my community, many of the tribes are not accepting new patients, and they may not provide services to a non-tribal member. So in the 50s, the federal government, in an effort to assimilate Indian people and encourage them to leave the reservation, they started a program, the Urban Relocation Program, and they provided a lot of incentives and encouragement to Indian people to leave the reservation, leave their tribal homeland, and actually settle in fairly large urban centers. So in 1940, only 10% of American Indians lived in cities, but by 1980, 53% of American Indians were living in cities, and today 78% of us live away from our home reservation. So the Indian Health Service, in response to this, set up a program. It's the Urban Indian Health Program. It's very, very small. There are 33 facilities around the country. They vary in size, vary in the services that are offered. They serve approximately 151,000 clients. I think I said there's over 5 million American Indians in this country, and 78% of them live away from home. So you can see this is a very tiny program. Makes up about 1% of the total IHS budget. And in lean years, particularly in the Bush administration, this program faced elimination nearly every year. And remember, it's a discretionary program. So as advocates, like myself, as a community advocate, you're constantly having to advocate for the program, lobby, which can become exhausting over time. So the next element is Medicaid and the role that Medicaid has played in upholding or not upholding the trust obligation. So there's increasing emphasis on Medicaid as a mechanism to fund health care for Indian people. But Medicaid is primarily for low-income children, pregnant women, the elderly, and disabled. So it leaves childless adults completely out of the equation. And typically, it's very low-income people. You know, at 100% of FPL. New Mexico, we do have a program, a waiver program, that goes up to 235% FPL, and it is available to childless adults, but it's waitlisted right now, and I think they'll actually be eliminating that now with healthcare reform. So the second piece with Medicaid, not only does it limit access to people who are eligible for it, but it is administered by states, and it's very vulnerable in when there's lean years and budget cuts. So New Mexico, even though our match rate is fairly high, coming up with those matching, the 30%, can be difficult. And then the state begins thinking about cutting benefits, changing enrollment, and so forth. And that leaves Indian people vulnerable to this system. So in Albuquerque, this picture just kind of describes one of our local challenges. The picture on the left, the upper left, that's our original Indian hospital in 1927. And it was located near downtown Albuquerque, and 100% of the patients were Native. And then in 1954, it was actually the Public Health Service at the time, they initiated an interesting relationship with the county government, and they created a partnership to build the Bernalillo County Indian Hospital. And that was constructed in 1954, and the intent was to provide services to Indian people and the local poor and indigent. I have to do a shout out for my mom here, who's in the audience, because she did her student nursing there, Bernalillo County Indian Hospital. So by 2007, it became the University of New Mexico Hospital, and you can see currently about 4 to 5% of the patients are Indian. But the kicker here, this hospital originated, it's actually located on Pueblo land, land that was ceded to the federal government to hold in trust and manage on our behalf. The federal government, on our behalf, initiated this arrangement with the county, this partnership. And the intent was to provide services to Indian people. But over time, that relationship changed, people moved, it became a university, the university began to run the hospital. And now, if you're American Indian and you want to go to the University of New Mexico Hospital and you want IHS to pay your bill, you have to be eligible for that contract health service program I shared with you earlier. So currently, we have over 400 different tribes represented in Albuquerque. I think only 3 tribes are actually eligible for paid services there. So I think it's a pretty amazing illustration of the federal government's failure to uphold their obligation. So just really quickly, I myself and many other advocates were really looking at the Affordable Care Act as an opportunity to actually strengthen and uphold the federal government's obligation to Indian people, but sadly, I think there's elements of it that are very, very good and can be very, very helpful, but I also think it was a missed opportunity in many ways. So this is very quick. There's other Indian-specific provisions, but I'm just going to cover 3 of them. With the Affordable Care Act, American Indians are exempt from the mandate to acquire qualified health coverage. They do not pay a penalty if they don't acquire coverage. And if they purchase insurance through a health insurance exchange and their income is less than 300% FPL, they're exempt from cost sharing. So they don't pay copays and deductibles. And then in order to encourage them to participate in the exchange, they have special monthly enrollment periods. But there are some interesting elements of the law that will affect Indian people's ability to benefit from these provisions. So number one, in order for these provisions to apply to you, you have to meet the definition of Indian, which means you have to be a member of a tribe. So there are over 500 tribes in the U.S., and each establishes its own membership. And many establish it based on blood quantum. This definition is less expansive than the definition that establishes eligibility for services through IHS. So in essence, you could be eligible for services from the Indian Health Service and be able to use the local facility, but you may not be exempt from the individual mandate or benefit from the provisions related to the exchange. The verification process, so determining who is an Indian, for the purposes of the exchange, is being left up to states as they design their exchange, or federal government if you do a federally facilitated exchange. And this process could be really, really complicated and arduous. Each tribe sets up their own membership. Some issue cards I'm from the Pueblo of Laguna, so I have a little card that shows that I'm a member in my blood quantum, but others don't do it that way. So in New Mexico, remember I told you Albuquerque, where I live, over 400 different tribes. And the process to verify this could be very challenging. In terms of the exemption from the mandate, Indian people have historically been very reluctant to purchase coverage. It's complicated. They've been reluctant to enroll in Medicaid, mainly because of the stigma. I mean, many Indian people, we're well aware that our ancestors ceded millions of acres in land to the federal government. Many of us feel like we don't need to be low income to get health care. We're entitled to that. Why should we enroll in Medicaid? And then there is a reliance on the Indian Health Service in many communities. Many people feel like I should just be able to go to IHS. I shouldn't have to jump through hoops to purchase insurance or enroll in Medicaid. And then finally, this is really important. There are a lot of cultural taboos associated with insurance. In many cultures, that's considered almost like betting on your own life or your health or wishing bad things could happen. It's not, Indian people don't always view insurance the same way other people would. And then finally, the Medicaid expansion. I'm sure many of you know, because of the Supreme Court ruling in June, it is states do not pay are not penalized if they don't expand Medicaid in 2014 to adults up to 138% FPL. And if this doesn't happen, it will leave thousands of American Indians uninsured. And interestingly, people whose income is less than 100%. FPL, even if they go through the exchange, they are not entitled to the financial assistance to purchase coverage, and the premiums will be unaffordable. So if Medicaid expansion doesn't go through, that's yet another example of this failure to uphold the obligation. So in conclusion, learning objective takeaway, Indian people don't get free health care. We did pay for it. And the federal government is legally obligated to provide that care, but through a series of policies, they have failed to live up to that obligation. One of the most powerful ways they've done this is by tying eligibility to services, tying that to residency and recognizing that people have moved away, and then that reliance on Medicaid, knowing that it's a state program. So as Native people, we need to actively participate in developing policy and especially implementing it with the Affordable Care Act. So thank you very, very much. Appreciate the opportunity to speak.